program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kepin family. We wish to thank them for their support. On our last Smithsonian program, we read an article titled American Vintage by Alex Mayasi. The nation's wine industry was once built on native grapes. Now one Missouri winemaker is restoring their vines to their former glory. So Mr. Eisterhold never intended to go into the wine industry. But while he was on a business trip in Lincoln, Nebraska, he stumbled on a book that changed his life. Titled Foundations of American Grape Culture, which was originally published in 1909 by somebody named Thomas Volney Munson. Eisterhold said it was like finding a trapdoor in the basement that leads to Jules Verne's Lost World. Around 2011, Eisterhold opened Terra Vox, which means, you know, the voice of the land, so which is a reference to Eisterhold's belief that working with local grapes is a conversation between him and the grapes. Some of these wines will take you on flavor journeys that you don't find anywhere else, he says. One of the grapes, which Munson named America, tastes remarkably like meat. Another, Cleota, tastes of cinnamon with smoky notes, which is common in dark beers and spirits such as scotch, but rarer in wine. Like a museum curator, Eisterhold continued to collect additional Munson grapes, such as Delicatessen, which he requested from a small Midwestern winemaker who had entered it in an amateur wine competition. He has never made profit and loss statements, instead subsidizing Terra Vox with personal savings and not taking any salary himself. To converse with Munson's grapes and realize their value often requires a spirit of experimentation and uncommon patience. During my visit, Terra Vox's head winemaker, Jean-Louis Hauveilleur, a well-bearded, Birkenstock-clad man whom Eisterhold and Smith, who's a wine consultant from California and Eisterhold's former professor, hired away from a Texas winery in 2019, described how during his first harvest, the challenge of working with dozens of unfamiliar varieties literally gave him nightmares. There were no ready-made charts based on hundreds of years of winemaking tradition, telling him when to harvest the grapes according to their sugar and pH levels, or how the grapes and wine would change if he waited, as there were for, say, the Tempranillo he used to work with back in Texas. There's more looming fears with these grapes, he says, more uncertainty. That uncertainty can lead to creative problem-solving. During the same harvest, Hauveilleur loaded a bunch of Wetumpka, a bright green grape that Munson first bred in 1893, into Terra Vox's wine press. The grapes were so pulpy that the press couldn't separate the skins and flesh from the juice, which sprayed onto the walls and ceiling. Hauveilleur, soaked and sticky, ended the day scraping fruit matter from behind his ear as he measured the disappointing yield of juice. When he made a note for next year, he'd pitched Eisterhold on fermenting the grapes with their skins on for a day before pressing, which would produce an orange wine, a style that's grown in popularity for the past decade, and might break down the pulp. A year later, in 2020, they successfully produced a cheery, almost tropical orange Wetumpka that is now a fan favorite. The Wetumpka is what Eisterhold sometimes calls a good missionary for his historic grapes. He and his staff increasingly abandon varieties that don't produce winning wine, winnowing their plantings from 60 grapes toward a target of 20. And in recent years, Terra Vox has received gold medals and silver ribbons from the San Francisco Chronicle and other wine arbiters. One of the secrets of making good wine is that a hell of a lot of stuff has gone down the drain, Eisterhold admits, because we can't afford to have a bad missionary out there. When I ask him if he feels he succeeded in earning respect for Munson grapes, Eisterhold replies, not yet. While Terra Vox has produced a palate-pleasing missionaries like Wetumpka, he aspires to create a big market of customers devoted to American grapes, and even to cultivate champions that, as the 19th century French wine critic predicted, would make Missouri a marquee destination for wine lovers. Today, as in Munson's day, North American grapes have something unique to offer the wider wine world. Their unusual hardiness and tolerance of heat are distinct advantages at a time when the warming climate is already affecting harvests. With grapes ripening weeks earlier than in decades past, and wineries struggling with water shortages, wildfire smoke, and springtime frosts. Forecasters predict that eventually climate change could shut down as many vineyards as Phylloxera once did, albeit with the twist that colder regions like England are seeing improved production. At the moment, winemakers are not racing to uproot their noble grapes and replace them with American grapes. But the slow machinery of the global wine industry is beginning to adapt to evident threats. One organizing body in France, for example, recently gave Bordeaux vintners permission to use six new grape varieties, all vinifera, but less popular and more heat tolerant in their strictly controlled blends. Eisterhold has sent cuttings to European breeders who are concerned about climate change. And a small but expanding number of wineries and restaurants in the Northeast and Midwest are growing and selling French-American hybrids, attracted by their resilience and sustainability. Eisterhold says that the potential for native grapes to make the wine world more resilient by increasing its genetic diversity has always been central to his project. Growing more kinds of grapes, he says, hedges your bets as we deal with what I think will be an increasingly uncertain and volatile future. At the very least, wine breeders could develop new grapes that contain trace amounts of North American varieties, just enough to provide benefits like heat tolerance. At Davis, Walker bred grapes with resistance to Pierce's disease, which kills vinifera but not American grapes that were still 97% vinifera. The implicit promise is to provide resilience while minimally sacrificing flavor. But if Eisterhold can help to garner respect and recognition for local grapes, that could go a long way toward convincing winemakers and wine drinkers that turning to non-European grapes is not a sacrifice or downgrade, but rather an opportunity for exploration. During the end of my visit to Terra Vox, I am struck by the contrast between these grand ambitions and the day-to-day work on the vineyard. At a tasting of five Terra Vox ports, a group of guests listens attentively to Hovayeur explain the history of Munson's grapes. Eisterhold adds that until Prohibition, Missouri was the Silicon Valley of wine. The patrons politely accept forms to sign up for the Terra Vox Wine Club. Most tell me they came to enjoy a creative date night or catch up with friends. I find myself wanting to shake them to make them understand how unique these wines are, how unlikely is that this winery would even exist. At the end of the evening, as I stand on the balcony of the tasting room, Eisterhold walks up to me. His cheeks are ruddy, from the sun, perhaps from the wine. He nods toward the nearest rows of vines, where earlier he showed me how to prune the canopies to ensure airflow through the vineyard. "I finished that section," he says proudly. This is what obsession and contrarian ambition looks like. Eisterhold in his wide-brimmed hat, shears in hand, making his way slowly down the row, methodically restoring a living thing from historical obscurity and shepherding it into the future. Each year he learns more about these grapes, and he believes that there are dimensions yet to be discovered. "These grapes deserve to live here because they came from here. They're adapted to here," Eisterhold told me. "Why haven't they been nurtured?" Next, we'll move on to an article by Cheryl Katz titled "Valley of the Reindeer." On Norway's Svalbard archipelago, a rare animal is thriving, for now. Perched on a snow-crusted hill in a glacier-flanked valley known as Rheindalen, ecology graduate student Emma Gerberg looks like a modern-day Valkyrie on a quest. Long blonde braids frame the scope at her eye as she searches for her target, a shaggy gray creature about the size of a large goat. It's a Svalbard reindeer, named after the cluster of Norwegian islands it calls home, and Gerberg is waiting for it to poop. Reindeer are super selective eaters, which their droppings reveal, explains Samantha Dwinnell, a PhD candidate in ecology, who is accompanying Gerberg on this trip to gather data on the unique Svalbard subspecies. The researchers, who include Olin Eichland, a master's student in biology, and research assistant Ida Cohn, come from different institutions, but they're all working on reindeer research at the University Center in Svalbard. In addition to feces, the group is collecting ancient antlers from the permafrost. Isotope analysis on these branching bones, shed and regrown each year, can reveal important details about past conditions. The researchers are also doing a status check on 23 specific reindeer with ear tags. That means hours hiking around the valley with an antenna, following signs from a target's GPS collar. Once they've located an animal, they hunt for a spot where it had grazed and painstakingly record the specific plant parts it has nibbled. They're fascinated by the way the animals somehow know which plants and which parts of plants are most nutritious at different times of the year. In the early summer, for instance, reindeer zero in on just the heads of certain specific flowers, such as a buttercup-type species called Coptidium spitzbergens. Studies show that animals that target the most nutrient-packed food have a higher body mass. It makes sense, Dwinnell says. They're not wasting their time on crap. The researchers, however, are focusing intently on what comes out the other end, and after nearly an hour, the reindeer delivers. The team springs into action, scooping up the specimen. The marble-sized droppings are a rich source of information on the animal's diet and health, such as what they've been eating, how stressed they are, and whether they're plagued by parasites. During the week they spend here, the women collect roughly 11 pounds of droppings, which they'll carry back to the lab for analysis. The archipelago of Svalbard is halfway between Norway and the North Pole. Its largest island, Spitsbergen, holds the world's most northern town of Longyearbyen. The coal mining town is now home to some 2,300 people, a busy tourism industry, and the university center in Svalbard, a Norwegian Arctic research institute. Scientists, along with Thando the dog, began their three-day journey to Rheindalen here, carrying 70-pound packs and rifles to protect themselves from the potential threat of polar bears. On day one, they scaled a glacier in a whiteout, feeling their way carefully to avoid crevasses. They plunged into chopping wood, hauling water, and other taxing chores before they could go to sleep in a rickety old hiker's shelter. Day two consisted of a 17-mile slog over cold, wet tundra to another hut, where corny jokes and sour gummies helped keep their spirits up. On day three, after another long hike, they arrived in Rheindalen, a lovely wide-open valley split by a meandering river. Rheindalen is a paradise for Svalbard reindeer, also known as Reingifar Tarandus platyrhynchus. Those eight tiny reindeer pulling Santa's sleigh in the classic poem A Visit from St. Nicholas must be Svalbard reindeer. They're the world's smallest, averaging just 3 feet tall and 5 feet long. Rheindalen's isolated location has largely protected the reindeer from disturbance by humans. And lately, as the rapidly changing climate greens the Arctic, these herbivores are thriving on a heaping smorgasbord of plants. In the fastest warming part of the planet, the Svalbard reindeer's relative success is a welcome contrast to the challenges facing many other northern animals. Thanks to extended growing seasons fueling abundant and nutritious vegetation, these reindeer can pack on enough pounds in summer to sustain them through the lean winter when starvation is the leading cause of death. As a result, the reindeer population in Rheindalen has quadrupled over the past 30 years and now numbers roughly 1,700. Similar benefits are being seen throughout the archipelago, where the total reindeer population, 22,000, has doubled since 1989. For the moment, at least, Svalbard reindeer seem to be in their Goldilocks zone, where conditions are just right. These animals are at a stage where things seem to be going well for them, says Dwinnell. But it is climate change, and climate change is change. As the Arctic continues to warm, even the reindeer will undoubtedly become too hot. Because these animals are adapted to the cold, warmer temperatures require them to regulate their body temperatures, sapping the energy they need to forage for food. And warmer winters can increase rain on snow events, which lock away the animal's food supply under an impenetrable layer of ice. The warming climate can also usher in parasites, invasive species, and disease. We need to keep an eye on these animals, Dwinelle says. We can't just assume that they'll be good forever. What do the researchers think about while they're out here watching reindeer day after day? You're in this little bubble and your life revolves around reindeer and dinner, Eichlin says. It's a very comfortable life, very simple. You don't have any mirrors. You don't think about how much your socks smell. And they really get to know the animals over time. They have their favorites, like weird R380, a loner who hangs out atop glaciers and other unusual places, and cutie B255, who loves to cuddle with her calf. They are so complex and they have so many little quirks, says Gerberg. You can really see that they have different personalities. That makes the knowledge of what's ahead for Svalbard reindeer especially heartbreaking. It's really hard not to get either depressed or very angry, says Gerberg, wiping her eye. As the group begins the long trek back to civilization, they're eager to return to Rheindalen again. I feel most alive when I'm out in the field with these reindeer, Dwinelle says. It seems like a harsh environment to be working in, but it is really as calming being out there. It is really a magical thing to be a part of. Now we'll move to an article in the prologue section of the Smithsonian by Tracy Shorn titled Freedom Fighter. Thaddeus Stevens is one of the greatest heroes in U.S. history. Why hasn't he gotten his due? Arguably the most important opponent of slavery in American history, Thaddeus Stevens is also the most forgotten. If the abolitionist Pennsylvania congressman is known at all today, it's thanks to Tommy Lee Jones's portrayal of Stevens in the 2012 film Lincoln, where he is a moral absolutist to Lincoln's pragmatic dealmaker on the 13th Amendment, a righteous scold with vicious one-liners and a bad toupee. Yet, at the time of Stevens' death in 1868, he was one of the most revered men in the country. When he died, he was only the third American ever to lie in state at the U.S. Capitol. Former Secretary of State Henry Clay was the first in 1852. Lincoln was the second in 1865. Thousands of mourners attended his funeral, but within years he lay in an unkempt grave in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, his legacy uncertain. Indeed, as early as the following decade, Stevens could lay claim to being one of the best-hated men in our past, his biographer Milton Meltzer wrote in 1967. Today, Thaddeus Stevens is finally getting his due. In Gettysburg, a scrappy band of citizens erected a bronze statue of Stevens in front of the Adams County Courthouse in April 2022. But the biggest honor is yet to come for Stevens and his companion, Lydia Hamilton Smith, when in the city in Lancaster, the preservationist group Lancaster History will open the Thaddeus Stevens and Lydia Hamilton Smith Center for History and Democracy in 2025. Designed by the same firm that built the Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture in Washington, D.C., the $25 million complex is a peon to Stevens' life work. The site will also showcase regional heroes of the Underground Railroad, including the work of Smith, a freeborn woman with African American heritage who spent 21 years of her life as Stevens' house manager and confidant, and some speculate his common-law wife. The center will celebrate their shared work helping freedom seekers and their rare working relationship of close respect across color and gender lines. As characters in American history go, Thaddeus Stevens does not cut a dashing figure. Born poor and club-footed, he was ridiculed for his disability, which at the time was considered a punishment from God. When he was 12, his alcoholic father abandoned the family, leaving his mother to cope with a farm and four children. She worked nights as a washerwoman to afford her son's school fees, a sacrifice that instilled him a lifelong commitment to free public education and a disdain for hereditary privilege. In 1815, he left his native Vermont for Pennsylvania to take a job as a school teacher, but he soon made his way into a law career, passing the bar in 1816 and moving to Gettysburg. Over the next 21 years, Stevens became a renowned trial attorney, businessman, and maverick politician in the state and federal legislature. He paid his mother back for her investment in him. One of his proudest accomplishments was purchasing her a 250-acre farm with 14 cows. In the decades before the Civil War, Stevens Corner of southeastern Pennsylvania was a crucible of pro-slavery and anti-slavery forces. The Maryland-Pennsylvania border was one of the most significant battlefronts in the fight around American slavery, says Richard Bell, a historian at the University of Maryland. Pennsylvania had abolished slavery in 1780, but in Maryland, less than 20 miles away from Gettysburg, it was legally protected. There are endless documented cases of black people being apprehended and then stolen away as they tried to enjoy the first fruits of freedom in Pennsylvania, Bell says. Not only did enslavers pursue fugitives, but there was also a reverse underground railroad where predators kidnapped legally free black people, often children, and sold them south into bondage. Bell estimates that there were tens of thousands of such abductions across the U.S., and Gettysburg was especially target-rich for bounty hunters. Stevens joined the front lines of resistance. By 1837, he was a vowed abolitionist, and that year he founded an ironworks outside of Gettysburg with the specific aim of employing free black men and freedom seekers. During the Civil War, Confederate General Jubal Early burned down Stevens's forge en route to the Battle of Gettysburg. In 1842, Stevens left Gettysburg for Lancaster to expand his law practice, but also continued his dangerous work harboring fugitives and running a resourceful anti-slavery spy ring extending throughout southeastern Pennsylvania. Stevens's spies managed to infiltrate groups of bounty hunters who regularly traveled to Adams and Lancaster counties. One of the most daring ploys was to pay off the secretary of notorious bounty hunter George Hughes, whose office on King Street in Lancaster was around the corner from Stevens's office on Queen Street. Hughes' secretary would copy the names of the wanted and immediately pass this information to Stevens' agents, who alerted anyone harboring freedom seekers. But Stevenson's greatest legacy came from his chairmanship of the House Ways and Means Committee during the Civil War, and later the Appropriations Committee during Reconstruction. Through indomitable grit and spirited political maneuvering, Stevens played the primary role in ushering through Reconstruction via constitutional amendments. He was the most radical of the radical Republicans, the fervent anti-slavery bloc. Stevens was thus a thorn in Lincoln's side, who agitated to end slavery with more force than the president would ever muster, calling it the most hateful and infernal blot that has ever disgraced the escutcheon of man. Stevens' arguments were crucial in ensuring the passage of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery, and historians acknowledge Stevens as the main architect of the 14th Amendment, which enshrined equal protections under the law. He also fought for universal suffrage, though he died 19 months too early to see black men casting their votes under the 15th Amendment in 1870. Many of Stevens's boldest ideas never came to fruition, such as seizing enslavers' land to redistribute it to formerly enslaved. Even so, he was unmatched as a political strategist. It's amazing what he does after Lincoln is assassinated, says Manisha Sinha, a historian and author of The Slave's Cause, A History of Abolition. By the end of 1865, President Andrew Johnson, whom Stevens called a damned scoundrel, had issued pardons to Confederate leaders, some of whom were then elected to Congress. Stevens, though by then nearing the end of his life, reminded the Confederate states who had won. He led an effort to require Southern states to ratify the 14th Amendment before those states could regain federal representation. The Jim Crow era was not kind to Stevens and his ideas of multiracial democracy. In the white supremacist film Birth of a Nation, Stevens is embodied by the villain Austin Stoneman, a power-hungry ogre intent on punishing the South, complete with limp and ridiculous wig. I started school in 1947 and suffered through Pennsylvania history, and I do not recall the name of Thaddeus Stevens ever being mentioned, says Leroy Hopkins, 81, a retired professor and local historian whose family has lived in Lancaster County since the 1700s. Radicals like Stevens, Sinha says, were seen as having overreached in championing black citizenship, and in the 1868 impeachment of Andrew Johnson for blocking Reconstruction. The myth that they achieved nothing is false, she argues. Reconstruction was the direct result of Stevens' parliamentary acumen and his devotion to egalitarian principles. Yet at the turn of the 20th century, Reconstruction was widely presented as a wicked, aberrant episode in U.S. history. We still live with those legacies, Sinha says, what makes it all the more important to recover a true idea of Stevens. Today, the battlefield town of Gettysburg finally has a new statue of Thaddeus Stevens, defiantly clutching the 14th Amendment in front of its courthouse. The prime mover behind the statue was Ross Hetrick of Gettysburg, a former Baltimore Sun reporter, who in 1999 founded the nonprofit Thaddeus Stevens Society. Hetrick argues that Stevens' memory was unfairly subordinated to that of Abraham Lincoln's. The genius of Lincoln is that he listened to Thaddeus Stevens, Hetrick says. With just 237 members, the society began organizing for a bronze statue in 2015, when Michael Charney, a retired public school teacher from Cleveland, and his wife, C.J. Prentice, a former Ohio State senator, stepped in to fund the venture. He was squelched. He never had the kind of impact he should have, Charney says of Stevens. An evangelizing effort, Charney once even went so far to name his dog Thaddeus Stevens so that he'd have daily opportunities to strike up conversations with strangers about this American hero. Stevens died in 1868 at the height of Reconstruction, a time of great promise. Just 9 years later, by 1877, Reconstruction had ended with the withdrawal of federal troops from the South, and Stevens' reputation was trashed. Yet those who remembered Stevens' fading legacy made pilgrimages to his grave. In the summer of 1886, a group of Black Civil War veterans gathered there and welcomed D. Henderson, a fellow veteran from New York City who had come to pay his respects at what he called the sacred spot. The men stood in formation and sang "Nearer, My God, to Thee," after which Henderson thanked Stevens for his hopeless fight in holding America to its stated ideals of justice and liberty for all. His virtue and the world's memory of his virtue will endure as long as time itself, Henderson said. To the veterans assembled that day, Stevens was the man who had championed their right to fight for the Union. He fought for the abolition of slavery, equal protection under the law, universal suffrage, and free public education, and he achieved it all, at least in the letter of the law. For his final act, Stevens chose to be buried in Lancaster's only integrated cemetery. His grave emblazoned, equality of man before his creator. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program is underwritten with the generous support of the Kevin family. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Smithsonian is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.